You're not worthless. I want to talk about what you're worth this morning. Can we do that? Yeah, if insurance company was going to figure that out today, they would talk about what you're worth in terms of your earning potential. And if that were to go away, you'd be worth a lot less in their eyes. If we were to try to figure out what you're worth from the medical world, it would probably be in terms of what organs you could donate, or you know, what organs could be used if they had to be donated. Sports world might base it on your marketable value. What would some other team pay for you to be on their team? What if we were to buy you to be on our team would guarantee that we'd be a winning team so that we'd make more money? This is audience participation. Money. And you'd be worth that to them. Wall Street wants to know your net worth. Your net worth. You know what that is? That's your assets minus your liabilities. Net worth, or in some cases, not worth. There are a lot of ways, aren't there, to measure what are you worth. And most of them are about what you will contribute to society. How much are you able to give to everyone else? That's your worth. Jesus reached out to people who weren't worth so much in everyone else's eyes. Little children were being brought to him. You know, little children don't contribute a whole lot to society. And the disciples said, get these kids out of here. And Jesus rebuked them, and he welcomed the children to him, and he embraced them, and he blessed them. He showed that they were worth something. People with leprosy were some of the most outcast and get-away-from-me people of the first century. There was a leper who came to Jesus. He wanted to be healed. Jesus didn't repel him. Jesus reached out and touched him. Jewish society hated tax collectors. Some things don't change. And guess what Jesus did? He went and had lunch at one of their houses. And then he made a tax collector one of his closest disciples. The Jews also hated Samaritans. Jesus was passing by a Samaritan village, and he involved a Samaritan woman in meaningful, deep conversation. His disciples were surprised that he even spoke to her. But Jesus treated her with love and respect. There was another woman that people wouldn't have cared about. She was from Syrophoenicia, another non-Jew. And Jesus even reminded her that a typical Jewish rabbi wouldn't waste his time on a woman like her. Yet she asked for just a crumb of care from Jesus, and Jesus gave her far more. Jesus was a friend to the outcasts, the hated, the ignored, and the sinful people who were lost and who needed someone to come into their life and point them in the right direction. He regarded all humans as valuable. He didn't size them up based on their net worth, their marketability, their earning potential, their usable parts. And that includes you this morning. You, as you are right now, this morning, according to God, are a valuable person. Enough that Jesus gave his life for you so that you could spend forever in heaven with him. Isn't that great news? That's the best thing that you can hear today. Living life around Jesus leads us to treat each other that way. All other people. Like they have real value, regardless of a whole list of other things that they may not have. And that includes you, whoever you are. So let's talk about your worth. Can we do that? I'm glad you asked that, Sherm. Yes, you can. We can do that. Good. What is it that makes you so valuable? Take a moment, turn to somebody nearby you. Would you do that this morning? And say to them, hey, you're a valuable person. Would you do that this morning? All right, now turn to them and say, you're really worth something. Doesn't that feel good? You're really worth something. You're worth something, and I want to talk about how we can know you're worth something, first of all. Okay, let's talk about what makes you so valuable. Here's the first reason. Number one, you're valuable because you're created in the image of God. You are created in the image of God. Genesis chapter 1, God looked at everything he had created, and he said about it, it is good. But when it came to making mankind, something was different. Up to that point, God had simply said, let there be, and things were brought into existence. He formed the animals and the birds out of the dust of the earth. He spoke everything into existence. But when it comes to forming man, there is this divine pause. And God says, let us make man in our own image. He made him in his image. He breathed his breath into man. And this image of God is the thing that makes us different from all the animals. Psalm 8, verse 5. The psalmist is just remarking about mankind and how God has made everything. And then he says about mankind, you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You see, when we act like something other than animals, we are showing that we bear this image of God in which he created us. You're valuable because you bear God's image. Isn't that good news? Here's another reason you're valuable this morning. Because this image is part of who we are, regardless of a person's size, age, ability, appearance, nationality, or location. You get that list? I list those things because those are often the things that we start checking off on a checklist when we start to evaluate somebody, aren't they? Charles Colson said it's one thing to want a healthy child, but it's another thing to refuse to let an unhealthy child see the light of day. When we manipulate life in this way and diminish the humanity of the unborn, we become less human ourselves because we end up viewing life, all life, ours included, as a commodity that can be rejected by quality control. You see, your age, your ability to function on your own doesn't change the fact that you're created in God's image. Where you've come from, what you look like, whether you wear diapers or Depends, doesn't change it. The Bible just doesn't indicate that there are some humans who are made in the image of God and some humans who are not. You're valuable because you bear this image inside you. And you're valuable because your life is eternal in nature. You know, the Bible tells us that everything about this world that you and I see and touch today, one day is going to be totally annihilated. That's not great news, but actually it is. It's all going to burn. About the time the car breaks down, that's a comforting thought to me. You're going to burn, all right? It's all going to be destroyed. The whole thing's going to be remade. There is only one thing that's going to last forever that's here in this world right now, and that's in this room right now. It's the soul of every human being. Human souls are the only part of creation that's eternal in nature. David writes in Psalm 139, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. No matter how much we throw our lives and our effort into it, everything that we can see right now is temporary. Only the unseen things are eternal. Doesn't it make sense? Doesn't it just make sense to put our effort in life into the things that are going to last the longest? This is the part where you nod affirmingly and go, yeah, that does make sense. Then our effort would go into things that we would value, things that are going to last forever, like human souls. Here's another reason you're valuable. Number four, because disregard for human life will come back on all of us at some point. It'll come back. And to illustrate this, I'd like to turn to an important theologian, Ebenezer Scrooge, who, when he was asked to make a contribution to the less fortunate and needy, remember what he said about them who wanted to die rather than live in the poor houses? Well, then they better hurry up and do it and decrease the surplus population. Remember that? And that was Scrooge's attitude, and that was fine until he had to apply it to somebody he cared about. Then suddenly, it didn't sound so good. What happens when people disregard human life? What happens when we lower our view of human life? Jonesboro, Paducah, Littleton, Virginia Tech, Orlando, San Bernardino, Columbine, Newton, Fort Hood, Charleston, Aurora, just to name a few. Martin Niemöller, who was a preacher in Germany when the Nazis came to power, he was eventually arrested for his opposition to the Nazis, said this. You've probably heard this quote. First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Every time we do anything that disregards any human's life, we simply increase the way that our own life and the lives of those that we love and care about are going to be less regarded. Did you hear me? Every time we do anything that disregards any human's life, we simply increase the way that our own lives and the lives of people we love are going to be disregarded. Just like those who remained silent in Nazi Germany were paving the way for the day they come for me. Erosion is a problem that people deal with, especially in some specific job lines. You got to deal with erosion. It's where land and things wear away. Wind and water do its work, and that chew away at earth. Even rock gets chewed away by erosion. Sometimes it happens slowly and it wears away till all at once underneath has worn away and there's a big collapse. And damage is done. And what was happening without being noticed is suddenly obvious. And then everybody goes back and looks at it and goes, oh, we should have done something about this erosion. We should have planted something that would hold the ground in place. We should have built a seawall. We should have directed the runoff somewhere else, because look what the erosion did. Well, I want to suggest to you today that the evidence around us, if we'll look at it, suggests that our regard for human life is eroding. And we need to get a grip on what's going on here, rather than waiting until it all comes crashing down and we step back and go, oh, I guess we should have done something about that. What's eroding the way that we look at human life? I want to suggest some things that show that, some causes of erosion. First one is this, and that's an evolutionary theory as the beginning of a worldview. Yeah, I'm going to slap around on evolution for a second, all right? If you accept the scriptures, if you accept that this book is true and what it says is true, if you accept that God created the world like it says in Genesis 1 and 2, then your view of the world is that there is a supreme being who brought everything into existence from nothing. That's your understanding and your belief if you accept that the scriptures are true, all right? That's how it came to be. That he created all animals, that he created man and woman, and your worldview starts with accepting that and everything that it implies. Now, throw out the Bible's account of creation, throw out its reliability where that's concerned, throw out this idea of a creator who made all that is from nothing, and what you do is throw out the uniqueness of human life. And your worldview now is drastically different. If we weren't created by God, like the scriptures teach, then all life's the same. All animals are just as important as any human. Baby trees are just as important as baby humans. And our worth is no greater than any other living thing. If we weren't created, then the ones to survive are the ones who are most fit to survive. Isn't that what natural selection is all about? Isn't that how it works? It weeds out the weak. It takes out the deformed so that the gene pool gets stronger. Who are we to upset that? If we weren't created by someone outside ourselves, then there's no outside source for what's wrong or right. You realize that? Man is his own God. My opinions about right and wrong are just as valid as your opinions about right and wrong. Here's another factor eroding human life. And that is the sexualization of our society. I talked 2 weeks ago about the issue of our sexuality. Folks, it's time that we speak up about this in regards to human life. Unwanted pregnancies are a result of human sexual relationships. Abortion is an issue of sexuality, first and foremost. The whole abortion industry, this industry that exists in our country as a way of making money, is driven by this idea of pleasure at no cost or little cost, actions without consequences. At least that's what they want people to believe about it. And the value of human life in this setup has to get in line behind the value of pleasure. That's what it's about. In the United States, simply harassing an endangered animal like a sea turtle, you reach into a sea turtle's nest and take one of its 1,000 eggs out, you can be fined for $10,500. That's because of the Federal Wildlife Conservation Act. Did you know that? Leave the sea turtles alone. Or prepare to write a check. Federal law since Roe versus Wade has paved the way for about 60 million unborn babies to be killed. 60 million. Since 1973, that is an average of about 3,750 human lives a day. About 3,000 people died when the World Trade Center was attacked. 3,750 a day. And the person who's performing it is being paid to do it. Now that's the outcome of this whole line of thinking. Human life becomes less important than convenience or pleasure. Call him or her an it. Call him or her a mass of tissue, an embryo, a fetus. That's a picture of my next granddaughter facing that way, by the way. She's a person with an identity, with a unique genetic makeup, with a human soul and a name. Here's what's happening to human life. It's called a slippery slope. Dr. Leo Alexander was a consultant to the Secretary of War in the Nuremberg trials. Those are the trials he tried all the war criminals right after World War II. He had access to accused Nazi war criminals in the medical community. And he wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1949 about what was called the slippery slope. How the compassionate killing of the terminally ill set the stage for the Holocaust. Listen to what he writes. These crimes had started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude of the physicians. It started with the acceptance of the attitude that there's such a thing as life not worthy to be lived. This attitude in its early stages concerned itself merely with the severely and chronically ill. Gradually, the sphere of those to be included in this category was enlarged to encompass the socially unproductive, the ideologically unwanted, the racially unwanted, and finally, all non-Germans. You see, once we decide to evaluate human life in any form because of age or potential or size or some other feature, we start down a path just like Nazi Germany. If people are worth less because they're unborn, well then maybe people are worth less if they have some physical deformity. And if those people are worth less, maybe people with a terminal disease are worth less. And if them, then maybe people who are just old are of less worth as well. And if them, then maybe people with lower IQs. And if them, maybe people who don't think like I do, or who aren't as pretty as me, or of other reasons, are of less worth. The Holocaust is proof that an entire nation could fall into some of the most horrible practices imaginable following this line of reasoning, and our own abortion Holocaust in the United States is proof of that. We don't have to accept it. And neither can we just sit back and act like it's not going on. I want this morning to challenge us to hold a biblical view of human life, period. That it is different than all other forms of life, and then I want to suggest some practical ways that we can help that happen in our lives and in the people around us. All right? What can we do to make a difference? What can we do to make a difference? Here's some suggestions. Number one, begin with your own heart. You know, it wasn't very many years ago that our own nation was still trying to figure out that a person's skin color has nothing to do with his value as a person. Have you figured that out in your own heart? Have you? That's a matter of the value of human life. I hope I don't need to encourage anybody not to go out and commit murder today. Anybody thinking about that? Yeah. I saw a flinch down here. Hopefully not. Hopefully nobody's going, yeah, I was planning on that after lunch today. Probably not. But listen to what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard that it was said to people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. And you're going, well, I'm fine. I'm not going to murder anybody. Jesus says, but I tell you, anyone who's angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raka, that means empty head, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, but anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Oh, wow, what's the big deal? Just like murdering somebody is denying the value of that person's life, Jesus is saying here, so is insulting and degrading a person, devaluing their life. We're not just the first generation to struggle with this, by the way, and neither is the problem of playing favorites something that just came up in the church. James wrote to the church in the first century, James chapter 2, verse 3, if you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, here's a good seat for you, but say to the poor man, you stand there, sit on the floor by my feet, have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Adults, I know you don't understand teenagers. I know, and you know that too, because when you were a teenager, adults didn't understand you. And by the way, teenagers don't understand you right now either. It's a mutual thing. Does that make us worth less? Does that make somebody less important? No. You know, toddlers, those little people, they're a lot of work, aren't they? They are a lot of work, but they're work that's well invested. And right here in the church, we've got these great opportunities to invest in those little people to help them be great big people one day. Kids Hope USA, by the way, is a great opportunity to invest in little people who need that because their lives are worth something. So have you bought into the lie that because someone else's problem isn't affecting you directly, you don't need to worry yourself about it? Have you bought into the lie that since some people live far away or speak a different language or have a totally different culture or look completely different from you, that somehow their life matters less than yours? See, you can't get out of bed in the morning without facing some decisions about your attitude about the value of human life. So start with your own heart on this before you start attacking someone else about it. All right? Let's start with our own hearts. Can I get a uh-huh on that? Let's hear is the second thing that we can do. Number two, teach the next generation a respect for all human life. All right, here's the audience participation thing again. Turn to that person next to you again and say this to them. Hey, you're really worth something, and so is everyone else. Try that one out. All right, now doesn't that feel good? But it's a little different now, isn't it? At home, we've got up on our wall a quote and a picture from George Washington Carver. Yeah, the peanut guy. Carver also had a lot to say about his relationship with his Creator. And I was impressed by this quote so that it's on our wall. He said, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and strong. Because someday in your life, you will have been all of these." This isn't going to come from universities. It's not going to come from the media. It's not going to come from movies or video games or the internet. The only way the next generation is going to develop a biblical view of human life is if they are able to hear it and to see it in their parents and grandparents. So we need to teach this next generation that respect for all human life. Don't just slough off the news that someone died overseas today. Make an effort to treat some of the weaker ones with special care in a way that your kids and your grandkids are going to see it. Help them understand this. This is why current news issues about human life, even far away, matter to us. Teach them to value human life. Here's number three. Support public policy that protects human life and oppose legislation that threatens it. Yeah, this is about your politics. And yeah, it should affect the way that you choose who will be leading our city, our state, our nation down the road. Now, I'm talking about making sure that policies and people that get through are those which show a right regard for human life. Folks, we live in the greatest country in the world in a lot of ways. One of the great things is we have a voice in this. We have an ability to impact this at a high level. So we need to use that. Amen? Let's go to number four. Here we are. Support godly efforts to help uphold human life at all levels. One of the places that you can do this locally is the Pregnancy Care Center. And they came today. Yes, what a coincidence. They're here. They came today with the bottles. Each year we partner with the Pregnancy Center and they bring baby bottles and we stuff money into those. And we take that money and give it to them. Because what they are doing is turning around and helping young women make right choices. And I think one of the most positive, affirming things that the church can do right away here locally is to support that kind of thing, to help young women make good choices, which are very difficult for some of them to make. Even if they have made bad choices that have gotten them in the position where they're at, we can help them make good choices. What's wrong with that? So this morning, I believe her name is Karen, sitting at a table back here with those bottles, and I encourage you, if you're able to help with that, to help out. That's a place we can help this happen, all right? Now, I've finished the introduction to this message. Let me go back to the beginning. Oh, yeah, here it is. Every human being is valuable enough that Jesus Christ gave his life for you. And the goal of that is for you to live with him forever in heaven. And I ask you this morning, what more could Jesus do to get the message across to you that you are very valuable in his eyes? What more could he do? I want to encourage you today to read the 139th Psalm. In fact, if you've got your Bibles and you didn't have it open to there yet, I want to encourage you to open up your Bible to Psalm 139. In fact, today you might want to have it there open right now and turn to it as a way of us getting ready for the Lord's Supper so that you can have it there to read today as a prayer to God during this time. Psalm 139 is written by David. He is marveling at God's omnipresence, the fact that God is everywhere. I just can't get away from you, is what he is saying at first. There's no place you can go, no escaping him. In fact, even before you're born, he knows you inside and out. David is just marveling at that. There is no secret to God. And at the very end, after saying all of that, here's what he prays. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. It's great to know that God knows us so thoroughly, isn't it? It's also terrible to know that God knows us so thoroughly, isn't it? We can try to run from that idea, or we can say, like David did here, search me, O God. Know my heart. You know, the Lord's Supper is a time for us to speak that way to God. To say to him, search me, God. Know me. Know my thoughts. Look into my life and see about me if there's something that needs to be changed, and point me the right way. Help me to change it. I know God already knows if there's anything like that in me. I already know if there's something like that in me. This idea of getting honest with God, it's not a new concept. Somehow, though, seems to me, like a lot of good things, we need to be reminded of it regularly. Just like we need to be regularly reminded of what Jesus did for us on the cross. And so here we are again this week, coming around the Lord's table, being reminded again of what he's done for us. Use that prayer today as a thought. Pray that prayer, Psalm 139, to God. And then, after we've had some time, we'll rise and we'll go to these tables around the room, this table here at the front. We'll share the Lord's Supper together. God's invitation is for anybody who loves his son and wants to honor him to remember his son in this way. We wouldn't exclude anybody from that. It is something very much for people who love Jesus. And so, if you love him and want to honor him, then we invite you to do so with us today around this table. Let's pray. Father, search our hearts. You already know us thoroughly, but even knowing that, we'll say it again. Look deep inside of us today. Help this to be honest time with you. We know there's nothing that we'll keep secret from you. Yet, God, somehow in the back of our minds, we tend to excuse and to try to live that way. Tear it away from us today. Search our hearts. See what's there that needs to be changed. Father, thank you for reminding us of that need. And thank you that here again, around this table, there are these reminders for us, lest in any way we would begin to forget what Jesus did for us on the cross. We thank you for his physical body, his physical blood that was given on our behalf. Reminders to us of just how valuable we are in your sight. So we thank you today in Jesus' name.